Hello and welcome back to another episode of Open Floor. I'm Andrew Sharp, and on the other line, Ben Golliver. What's up, man?
Not too much, Andrew. I got to give you a lot of credit because you painstakingly went through 3 months of questions, ordered them, picked out the heat. I mean, some of these questions are really good, but I'm calling you out right off the top, man.
What?
You didn't include any of the questions or the responses from people to openfloormail@gmail.com who were pretty excited about your return. I mean, you had a lot of opportunities to kind of scratch your own back with this list, to kind of call me out. We got a lot of people saying, thank God Andrew's back. Ben was a little rough hosting. And you're way, maybe you're getting too mature. Maybe over 30 Sharp has gone too far, because you really could have gloated with this batch of questions, and you didn't.
Look, man, I'm just trying to stay humble. I'm trying to do my job, take it a day at a time, one game at a time, one pot at a time. And, you know, this is a team effort here. It's not about me. It's about us.
Well, I love that you say that, because I'm also going to just blow up this mailbag question with, before we get to all the rest of the questions, with a contribution from Kevin Durant himself. And you just said it's about us. It's about team. And Kevin Durant happened to tweet this morning, the game will always be about buckets. When it comes to buckets, there was nobody like T-Mac. Number one in the Hall of Fame. Respect, OG. So you are at a clear crossroads here. Is it really about team, or is it about buckets? I think it's time for you to officially pick a side. Are you with KD? Is basketball a buckets game, a bucket getters game, or is it a team sport?
Listen, you know where I stand as far as buckets are concerned. And honestly, I didn't see that tweet from Durant, but that leaves me pretty conflicted, because it's been hard over the last year and a half or so with KD, because I still love his personality so much. But then every now and then, like the stuff where he plays the victim with, like, as far as fans are concerned and everything else, like his stuff about loyalty, people aren't mad that he left OKC. People are mad that he went to the Warriors. So anyways, KD annoys me, but I still love his personality. I agree with his outlook on basketball, and it's a conflict that is currently unresolved.
Yeah, I thought we had done it. I thought we had turned the corner, that you realized basketball was a team game, and that real plus minus should factor heavily into your thought process, and that winning would be a big deal, because clearly that was, you know, not necessarily a part of T-Mac's resume. But what can we do? Let's get on with these questions.
The game is about buckets, and speaking about buckets, speaking about loyalty, let's talk about Russell Westbrook. Our first question is from Ethan, who says he actually told a longer story about how he's from Seattle, and when the Sonics left, he was sort of left without a team, and he floated to the Celtics to cheer for Ray Allen, former Sonic, for a few years. And then when Ray Allen left, he wound up getting full bore behind the Thunder and KD, and then KD left, and he's stuck here watching Russ, and he says, am I safe rooting for Westbrook in the hopes he never leaves OKC? So that question came in like mid-July, and we never got to it. And at that point, I think we both would have said yes, because I sort of expected him to take the extension like mid-August. Out of nowhere, that news would come through. He still has not taken the extension. OKC, I think it's like a $200 million offer. What do you think is going on with him right now?
First of all, I'm picturing this questioner just rocking cold sweats, really uncomfortable.
He's
for like
been
the
through
last,
a lot. Prayers up
no,
for Ethan.
But even more than that, like the last 2 months, if he was already worried about this like at the beginning of the summer and it's unresolved, like that's a tough spot to be in here in mid-September. Here's the tricky part for me. First of all, you know where I was on the John Wall one. Get it right. Done, even if that means committing to sort of this situation where you're the best player on a team that's never truly a threat. Take the money and run. Just do it. All those same things to me apply with Westbrook. And I would add even an extra layer. Like, as much as people want to say, okay, John Wall, that's like, you know, Washington's, you know, player. I mean, yeah, sort of. I wouldn't necessarily say he's on the same level in terms of connection with the city that Westbrook has ascended to in Oklahoma City. The tricky part for me, though, is that I thought the exact same thing about KD. I mean, I was part of the trouble in rationalizing or coming to terms with KD's move is that he would actually turn his back on Oklahoma City and do what was best for himself. Now, with Westbrook, he's a different guy. And, you know, I was kind of wondering, like, what's Westbrook up to? And I just went through my email this morning, and this is what I got. On behalf of Barney's New York, we would like to invite you to cocktails and conversation with Russell Westbrook and Daniela Vitale. Now, I don't know if she's related to Dick Vitale. I would assume not, because it's a style book that they're hosting as part of Fashion Week in downtown New York City. So this guy's on his own plane. I think he's just up to stuff. I think it's all going to play out at the right point. I think his identity is so wrapped up in sort of this anti-hero, now I do what I want, martyr ball that we saw in Oklahoma City, that that's where he's going to be, one way or the other. I think the bigger question to me is whether Paul George is going to be there alongside of him, but I just can't see him shaking out of his identity, which I think is wrapped up in not teaming up with others, of being the foil to the super teams, and the loyalty factor, which doesn't really apply to tons of stars in the league anymore, but I do think applies to him.
Yeah, he's sort of made it part of his brand, whether he intended to or not, over the last 12 months or so. The Barney's email is pretty funny, because it's like, within the media, like, Russ doesn't really grant interviews to sports magazines very often, but if you want him to appear at like a fashion show, or if GQ wants to interview him, or like he was on Stephen Colbert last year, like if it's not about sports, Russ is down for whatever. But as far as basketball writers, he doesn't really give a shit, which is kind of great. I kind of like that about him. But as far as the contract thing, you mentioned the John Wall situation, and we talked about the Wall thing over the summer. Like, I thought a lot of the speculation there was a little bit overdone and overdramatic. But I think this is different because, like, the Wall had a real dilemma where it was like, if he waited and made another All-NBA team, he could make more guaranteed money and get a little bit more security for an extra year. And that might have been worth it. Like, but he ended up taking the money, like, halfway through July. Russ, the offer is not going to change. Everyone in Oklahoma City has been waiting for this since July 1st. And he knows the stakes. Like, he knows what it implies if he doesn't take the extension. And Sam Presti sort of has to know that as well. Because, like, if he doesn't take the extension, and I think he's got until, like, mid-October to do it. I mean, Presti's might consider dealing him, right?
Yeah, I don't know. I think once they made that Paul George trade, that was sort of the all-in move, you know? I mean, to me, like, if I'm Sam Presti, I'm trying to ride it out with Westbrook one way or the other, and if he leaves, then I'm just throwing an absolute temper tantrum, you know, like Kevin Pritchard style with the Sabonis and Oladipo trade to Adam Silver and just be like, look, what do you want me to do? Like, this is an impossible situation for small market teams. I don't know. I don't see that trade scenario coming back in. I mean, I think it would potentially be logical, but I think once you make that trade for Paul George, you've kind of committed to a path here. Like, you've said to Westbrook, look, we're trying to win. We're trying to have you be the guy. We're trying to bring you the help that you need. We're doing everything that we possibly can. Work with us. I think that's sort of the approach right now.
Okay. Well, before I respond, next question. Andrew says, first of all, welcome back. First podcast I've ever subscribed to, and I've been following since the beginning. You guys do a fantastic job. Now, let's get crazy. Paul George and OKC isn't working out, and the Thunder realize they aren't going to keep him. So they turn around and flip him to Cleveland for the Nets pick, realizing they don't want to lose him for nothing. So, Ben, I need you to dream with me for a minute. You've already kind of shut down my dream, but I didn't even run this by you earlier in the week, and mostly because I didn't want you to bring me down. This came in on a Wednesday afternoon, and my mind just started racing. So what if we go with the nuclear option here? It would be maybe the biggest trade the NBA has ever seen. But why can't Paul George and Russell Westbrook go to Cleveland? And we can all just watch the world burn.
Wait, Westbrook's going to go to Cleveland too? So that was that next summer? Or how are you getting Westbrook to Cleveland?
We're trading the Nets pick. We're trading Kevin Love. We're throwing in Iman Shumpert and Jay Crowder, who is also an asset in his own right because of his contract. And that's not a bad deal.
Oh, my God, dude.
Look.
Come on.
How stupid
do you think Sam Presti is? This is really what you're going to throw at me? You had a week to prepare for this podcast. That's the best trade proposal you could come up with. Give me a break.
No, everything I said
earlier about you coming back being great, I take it all back.
It's not at all inconceivable. Well, it's pretty inconceivable. But let's say that there's a 5% chance that this happens. Let's say that the Nets start out this season.
You're just wasting our time right now.
I'm not. The Nets could be a train wreck out of the gates over the first 6 weeks of the season. And then the Thunder, let's say the Thunder are a train wreck. You know, one of those guys gets hurt. Paul George and Russell Westbrook just aren't enough to sort of hang in the West, or the show, as you like to call it. And it looks like they're going to be like a seventh seed. So if they get to January and Russ hasn't signed an extension, Paul George is gone after this year, and I think everybody sort of knows that, it's probably going to be time for Presti to start thinking about a rebuild. And I don't know if he's going to do better than getting a Nets pick back for Russ and Paul George. And I don't think he's going to do close to like anywhere near as well if he's just trading Paul George. So you get like a top five pick back and you press restart. And then you also get Kevin Love, who you can turn around and auction off, and Jay Crowder in the same. Jay Crowder, probably not worth a first this year, but as the cap gets tighter over the next few years, like, you could probably get a first for him. And then you've got 1 year of Shumpert for your trouble.
Yeah. I mean, I'll give you points for creativity. You're thinking way outside the box here. Unfortunately, a little bit too far outside the box. I think, first of all, let me just say, I think Westbrook's going to sign the extension. All right.
Okay.
If he doesn't, I still think if you're Presti, your best play in the situation where he's just hanging, you don't know what's going to happen with him, is that if the pairing doesn't work with Paul George, and I've said previously, I'm not sure it's totally going to work. I mean, I think that their ceiling is not like championship contender with this group, but it is, you know, conference finals for sure. But I also think their floor is probably fairly high, maybe higher than I was giving it credit for earlier this summer, just because of where they ended last year and the significant talent improvement they had over the summer. So
Paul George is really good. Paul George, if he's your second best player, you're in great shape.
Yeah, and even if it doesn't work perfectly, I guess, you know, you're still going to be in a good spot. But let's say they get halfway through the season, they're not gangbusters, you know, the Lakers rumors for Paul George are picking up, et cetera, et cetera. I think at that point, Presti's better play than blowing up his entire franchise, angering everyone about Russell Westbrook, and entering like a 9-year rebuild, which is what you're, you know, laying out for him, would be to go to Westbrook and say, look, I took a shot on Paul George. I think we can both agree it's not working out. I have to trade him. I'm going to do right by you. You know, we're partners in this. You know, we've been there. We've given you every best offer we possibly could. Hang with me, and we'll get the right supporting package around you. I still think that's the better play by a long shot for Oklahoma City than what you're describing.
Yeah, I guess so. But, I mean, if he looks to trade Paul George at the deadline, he's not going to get much back. And that's the thing. Like, there have been all sorts of people since the Kyrie trade was finalized saying the Cavs should give up that Nets pick for Paul George. But that would be like a pretty big overpay now. If they do it midway through the year, it'd be a huge overpay. And I think that, like, if you're Presti and you know you're going to rebuild, I don't know. You're not going to do any better than starting off with a top five pick this year. Then you go into next year knowing you're going to struggle and probably tank. And then from there, like, that's a good start to sort of rebuilding everything.
Well, I think Cleveland is an unusual buyer in this situation because I agree with you in general. Paul George's market isn't going to be great if everyone's worried about him just going to the Lakers. But if you're Cleveland, your back's pressed against the wall. LeBron wants to win. You know you don't have enough. Isaiah's still not back healthy. And you get to the trade deadline and you've got that Nets pick and your options are DeMarcus Cousins or Paul George as the best stars who are available by trade. Aren't you starting to think about Paul George with that pick? Now, all of a sudden, isn't there a market for Paul George, even on a very short-term rental, given Cleveland's desperation? I would think that there would be.
Well, sure, I guess. I mean, I'm not really sold, but if the argument is that the Cavs will be crazy enough to make that deal, I can kind of buy that, because the Cavs have made all sorts of irresponsible, short-sighted decisions.
Not even crazy, just desperate. I mean, there's a difference, right? It would be a logical, it would be a logical move. It would just be like, we're backed against the wall. We don't know what to do with LeBron. This isn't going right. The Isaiah thing hasn't panned out because he's not back. We got to get him some superstar help. And we still don't have anyone, even with Crowder, who can truly defend Kevin Durant. Let's take our shot. I just think Cleveland is more likely to be in a situation where they go all in to blow. And then, you know, the downside is everything blows up and they have to have a couple of rebuilding years. Than Oklahoma City would be. I think that that franchise values a certain level of respectability, and they'd be cool just kind of motoring along, you know, winning 44 to 45 games rather than totally sabotaging and tanking hard or putting them in a situation where that would be a very realistic option. I think that's their last course of action they would want to avoid at all costs, basically.
Okay. Well, I grant you that this is like not ever going to happen, but I guess my argument for OKC doing this deal would be that if they know Paul George is going to leave, they know it's not really working out this season. I don't know if you're Sam Presti in that spot and Westbrook hasn't signed the extension and you look up and down the roster, even if they could trade Paul George for the Nets pick, is it really that attractive to build a team around Westbrook, who's 28 or 29 at this point, a 19-year-old rookie, and try to sell yourself basically on the chances of ever really contending with Russ as your best player?
Yeah, it is, because the alternative is that nobody goes to your games, and you know this history of basketball in Oklahoma City that they've worked really, really hard to build up into a kind of a thriving community just goes away because you're a 25-win team and you're terrible. Look, they love Russ. They would let Russ play 1-on-5 for 5 years. And they don't care if they're really winning or not. I mean, he's at that point.
That's completely
fair. It's just a unique situation. Like, I get what you're saying in a vacuum in terms of, like, if the Paul George thing doesn't work and it's just Westbrook by himself, that is going to get bleak. There's no doubt about it. And it's going to be really weird when he's making like $33, $34 million. And, you know, they're still trying to make it with Roberson. Like, maybe he's going to have a jumper this year. Yeah. And it's like 2022. I am with you on
mechanics.
That. Yeah. We got him a new shooting coach, you know, brought Mark Price in. But I think that they would still prefer that to the alternative that you're describing.
Okay. Well, I guess I think that scenario is darker than people realize, and I wonder whether Presti has more fear about a Durant sequel than we think he does. And also, I had a lot of fun imagining Russell Westbrook, J.R. Smith, LeBron, Paul George, and Tristan Thompson as our Warriors foil, with Isaiah coming off the bench. That would be fucking awesome. And I think we should all be rooting for that scenario, the nuclear scenario. But thank you for indulging me.
Here's the one wrinkle, though. Would Westbrook even want that? Would he want to go play on LeBron's team?
Yes. Yes. People talk about Russ like he's a psychopath. And that's fair to a degree. But I don't think Russ, especially if OKC was treading water this year, I don't think he would look around and say, I don't want to play with LeBron.
Yeah, it's weird because we just never hear from him. I mean, you're basically putting all of these thoughts into his mind, and I'm putting all of my counter thoughts into his mind because he never really addresses the subject. But I would wonder about that. You know, he seems pretty happy there in Oklahoma City as the guy.
Whatever, man. It's September. Let me dream about my fake Cavs contender. All right, next question. Barack says, we got two questions about NBA heights this week. I don't know whether something happened regarding NBA Heights. Maybe it's all Isaiah related, but two height questions here. Barack says, it's often said that although Durant is listed at 6'9", he's actually closer to 7 feet. Similarly, Isaiah is listed at 5'9", but he's probably closer to 5'7". My question is this, which NBA players lie most about their height? Other question about height, Andrew says, why are players allowed to list themselves at heights taller or shorter than they really are? P.S. I'm helping make LeBronzo a thing. So one at a time, my answer to Barack would be, I'd say most point guards are like 2 inches shorter than they're actually listed. Like Chris Paul is probably 5'11". Damian Lillard is a guy who's much smaller in person, and I don't know. I don't even know what he's listed at. But do you have an answer?
I think that historically the answer has been the shooters who are actually over 7 feet that basically dealt with like years and years of stigma of being a soft 7-footer who didn't want to go inside. And so they basically always came down at 6'11". I mean, that's kind of been reported on and talked about. I agree with you that it's always going to be on the fringes, right? Like the point guards are going to be the most likely to lie in the, you know, on that end of the spectrum. But I also think guys who are perimeter oriented players who grew up, hit 7 feet and were like, oh no, I don't want to have to go bang inside. That's not really my game. I'm just going to pretend that I'm still 6'11" for the rest of my life. I think there's a lot of that. That's actually one reason why I give Kristaps Porzingis a lot of credit, because he says he's 7'3", and like that's the type of player where if he grew up like Kevin Durant, he would probably like really try hard to pretend that he's 6'11", even though there's no possible way he'd be able to get away with that. And I just love that about him, that he keeps it real on the stat sheet. But I'm kind of with these listeners. Let's audit this, you know, let's do a new combine for NBA vets. And the other thing too is like, and this is something that I came across with the OJ Mayo story. It's like once you come in and you have a list weight, like that doesn't really get changed a lot, right? And you know, he's basically talking to me about how he's like 30 pounds over his list weight or something like that, you know, during his offseason because he got injured after surgery. There's a lot of fluctuations out there with the weight. I say we get these guys, you know, like I said, in a veteran combine, and let's take new measurements.
That's fair. I come at it from the opposite end of the spectrum, though. I like that the heights are always vague. And speaking of which, I looked up Lillard's height. 6'3", there's no way he's 6'3". You've been around him in Portland a bunch. Like he can't be taller than 6 feet, right?
I think he's taller than 6 feet, but I'm taller than him, and my list height is 6'3.5". So,
and you're honest, all right? If there's one thing that you value, it's accountability. As far as the heights, though, I think it's great that Durant lists himself at 6'9 and tells women that he's 7 feet tall. That was in the Chris Herring story about this phenomenon a couple years ago. And yeah, I it's one of the things I enjoy about the NBA is that you can always sort of second guess listed metrics. Like God knows what Marcus Smart was listed at weight wise last year, but he's someone who was legitimately fat by the time the playoffs arrived. And yeah, I enjoy it. So I don't have a problem with any of this.
But I like, feel like
keep the NBA weird.
I think the listing is it's kind of aspirational too, right? It's sort of like being their best self when they turn in their list heights and weights, you know, it's like what they really want to be. But I don't think that we should say this is like unique to basketball or pro sports. I mean, I think this is, you know, probably a gender-wide phenomenon, you know? I mean, do you give people your actual weight when they ask you? Like, God forbid someone asks you that in public, but like, or do you, you know, round down a little bit?
I round down. I don't really round. I don't know my actual weight. And my actual height, I stopped tracking because when I was younger, doctors used to tell me, like, to be nice because I wanted to play basketball, and doctors would be like, yeah, like, you're going to be, like, 6'3 one day. And so I would always tell people that and tell myself that. And then eventually I just leveled off around like 5'9 or 5'10. And I don't ever want to measure myself to know how actually short I am, in part because I'm still pissed off that I was lied to for like 10 years.
This got really sad. Like, I'm over here, like, grabbing Kleenex, dabbing my cheeks. I mean, that was really rough. Well,
look, I
at
still
least
have
your doctors had
knees.
A good heart.
I still have working knees, unlike you, so I'm good.
Below the belt shot. Next question.
Next question from Jackie. Why isn't San Antonio's banana boat dream called Banana Antonio, like LeBronzo and Illuminike? Thank you for that, Jackie. We're not going to encourage Ben's nickname generation.
That's a brilliant idea, Jackie. I can't believe I didn't think of it, and we're definitely calling it that. The Banana Antonio, though, had a tough summer. You know,
it's not
the more that I went back and looked at the Spurs, oh man, like it's not looking great.
Yeah, topic for another day is how the Spurs plan to build around Kawhi and whether Kawhi would ever possibly leave San Antonio, because he's currently either the third or fourth best player in the NBA, and he's a free agent in 2 years, and the Spurs signed Rudy Gay, re-signed Pau Gasol this summer. I don't really know what the plan is. Unless the plan is to just turn DeJounte Murray into an all-star, which I can get behind that, but I don't know. The future in San Antonio is a little bit more interesting than meets the eye.
It's definitely possible they don't win 50 games sometime in the next 10 years. It's getting dicey down there.
Yeah. Well, and Kawhi also, it's hard to imagine him ever even like taking meetings with another team because he's such a Spur, but it's something to think about anyways. Next question from Benjamin says, there's rough consensus about who the franchise players are: Westbrook, Curry, Durant, LeBron, Kawhi, Harden, in some order, but there's much less consensus about who belongs in the next tier of players. For example, 7 to 15, who would you put in that next tier? Well, good news for you, Benjamin. Golliver has spent the past month of his life debating this, and we'll have SI's official top 100 debuting next week. And so I think 7 to 15 will become clear by like Wednesday or Thursday of next week. And then he had a second part to the question. So we're not going to rank 7 to 15 right now because we're going to yell about that next week. But he says, if acquiring a franchise player is nearly impossible, then a front office's best bet may be to acquire someone in that next tier who has the potential to make the leap, like Anthony Davis or Karl Anthony Towns. And I agree with that. And he asks, which ones have the most and the least upside? I agree with that. I also just think that at this point, people like price in potential to make the leap into the way we value players. So like, if you're trying to trade for Giannis or Karl Towns right now, you'd have to give up as much or maybe more than you'd have to give up to trade for James Harden or Chris Paul or whoever you want to put in that top like franchise player category.
Yeah. Well, so first of all, there's no question. I will give him a second tier. I will give him a third tier. I will give him fourth, fifth, sixth, seventh.
It will be annotated. It will be exhaustive. Everything you could ever dream.
15 tiers, but I do want to kind of just mention a few names in terms of the second tier. He got the first tier right. I mean, those are the six players. I mean, after that, I think you're looking at guys like Giannis, Anthony Davis, Jimmy Butler, Paul George, Chris Paul, Draymond Green. And usually in this second tier group, I'm very hesitant, and I would respond to his question by saying, look, like the second tier guys are just about as hard to get as the first tier guys. Like, you can't really build a long-term strategy around getting one of those players unless you already have somebody on deck. But when you look at those names that I just mentioned, Chris Paul, Jimmy Butler, Paul George, you know, all did move. Anthony Davis is going to be in trade rumors here for the next 3 years. You've been trying to, you know, leverage Giannis out of Milwaukee, which is not going to happen. So you need to stop doing that. But I guess the point is here, these second-tier guys are now taking a little bit more ownership, and I think they're maybe getting a little bit more honest about their place in the league, and now they're becoming up for grabs here in this kind of like team-up environment. So I think a lot of this second-tier stuff is still unsettled. I just think if you're a situation where you don't have a tier-one guy, your shot at getting a tier-two guy is getting more and more difficult the way that the players have kind of taken this the last couple summers.
Yeah, I go back to what I said earlier. I think I'm right. I think that the tier two guys are, if anything, the reason they're in tier two is because they're still young and still developing, and they are harder to get. I think.
No, I disagree. I disagree because I think I tend to favor guys who have proven it. So you've got Chris Paul in that category. You've got Jimmy Butler, Paul George, definitely are tier two players. Draymond's definitely a tier two player. Those guys are not overvalued based on potential. They're doing it because they've been all NBA guys year in and year out, and they're in their primes. They're peak guys right now.
Yes, but even if you go back, like, let's not look at the Chris Paul trade this summer because he was going to leave and they were just getting back whatever they could. But if you were trying to trade for Chris Paul last year, I think you could have gotten that deal done for less than it would have taken to trade for Karl Towns.
Yeah, I think you are going to have, if you have a guy on a rookie contract, that's always going to inflate his trade value. There's no question. That doesn't make him a better player. I mean, we're talking about the best guys right now going into next season, not the best trade assets or the best, you know, the guys with the most trade value.
Yeah. Well, I would, as far as tiers are concerned, I guess my real answer to this question is, if he's looking for a strategy, I would say you go third tier and try to build a foundation that is attractive enough so that a guy in the top 15 tries to push his way to your team. And that's what Boston did with Hayward. Like, neither Hayward nor Kyrie are probably like top 15 guys ever, but I think they provide a stable enough foundation that Boston now has a real shot, which is a good segue. Let's revisit the Celtics trade for, I'm going to give us like 5 minutes since we've already done, we've already talked so much about this.
Hold on a second though, because I think we should maybe consider an alternative here where our advice to fans should not be stick with the team and pray that five dominoes all line up, that you get Horford, that allows you to get Hayward, that allows you to get Kyrie. And I guess the first step of that whole equation was, you know, having Isaiah completely break out. I mean, that is not a very repeatable and workable plan for like some random franchise. And there's so many teams that are being left behind here. I mean, how many of these teams around the league do we just not even mention in this discussion at all in terms of turning yourself into a contender? I wonder if our recommendation to be to someone in his position is forget about the franchise, pick your favorite players and just ride the wave with them. Whoever it might be, whether it's Giannis, whether it's John Wall for you, whether it's a guy like Rudy Gobert in Utah where, you know, his world gets turned upside down because Hayward decides to leave. If you just have that cult of personality, rally behind your favorite guy and just go all the way with it, that will probably be a more pleasurable experience over the course of the next 10 years of fandom than just praying for 20 of these teams that have no shot for everything to go perfectly right for them so that they get into the mix.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's generally my recommendation to any fan. And I think that's sort of how fans end up watching the sport anyways. So it's all good. You don't have to trade for those first two guys. You can draft those guys too. But that's the best way to land one of the elite stars, unless you draft them. But
yeah, and that's the thing is, like, my other advice would be, okay, the best way to get these players is to basically do the process, right? I would never wish the process upon my friends. You know, it's funny to watch. It's funny to watch, you know, from 2,000 miles away as the Philly fans like went through it. But I would not wish that on anybody. And it's really hard to tell somebody like, yeah, like be as diehard as Liberty Ballers for the next 5 years. And it may pay off with 30 games of Joel Embiid once, you know?
Yeah. Well, we'll address the process later in the podcast. Next question from Joseph. He says, I'm pulling my hair out over reactions to the Kyrie trade. Someone needs to drop the hammer and counter all the BS that Bill Simmons is spouting. Andrew, I'm looking to you because Ben seems starry-eyed on Kyrie's ability to make tough shots, which is an intrinsically unsustainable approach. Okay, first of all, I will always, as far as Bill is concerned and the Kyrie pod, I'll always be like a Simmons stan, and I think the people that hate on him are generally pretty corny. But every now and then at Grantland, we would be talking hoops, and the Celtics would come up, and it would be like, whoa, like Bill really is a fan. Like, he really, really, really believes in Marcus Smart. And that's how listening to that Kyrie pod was for me. I'm the same way about the Wiz, so I can't judge. I remember telling people that KD would average like 35 a game with John Wall, like it was an objective fact, and as if anyone who didn't believe that must be crazy. So I totally get that side of it. But both Bill and just all Boston media has been on one with the Kyrie hype over the last like 2 weeks. So,
well, I also think this questioner has been on one because on the one hand, I'm taking shots for being starry-eyed over Kyrie. Where on the other hand, we had another emailer last night saying, why do I hate the Celtics? So which one is it? I think Kyrie just brings out the fire in everyone.
He really
does. I think that's
does.
Really, that's really what it comes down to is he's the accelerant because there's no like soft kind of wishy-washy takes on Kyrie. You're either in or you're out.
You're either like Kyrie is the next Kobe or this emailer who's a Wiz fan, and which I love. He first of all chides them for overpaying. I don't think it was an overpay because given the condition of Isaiah's hip, like Kyrie kind of bails them out in a huge way. And so you do whatever it takes to make that deal happen. But then he's at one point compares him to Mo Williams because this myth that LeBron was somehow holding Kyrie back is nuts. And LeBron turned Mo Williams into an all-star. And then he also says, yes, Kyrie is a chucker. Just watch the critical shot late in the fourth quarter of game 3 in this year's finals when Kyrie over dribbled, clanked a terrible contested fadeaway late in the shot clock. It's Kyrie pulling Ben Gordon type shit. So I respect the level of hate there. Comparing him to Mo Williams and Ben Gordon is pretty real. And I fully expect, I look forward to a year full of Wizards fans hating on Kyrie.
Yeah, just went too far there. Just went a little too far. We need to rope him back in. I mean, I hear what he's saying. These are concerns that we've raised time and again. I mean, I don't consider Kyrie a top 5 point guard in the league. That's part of the reason why. But he did hit a finals winning shot. We should probably give him credit for that.
He's gotten a lot of mileage out of that finals winning shot, though. I feel like that finals in 2016, it was really the second half of that series where he took over. And he deserves a ton of credit for it. He was amazing. And that version of Kyrie is definitely worth what the Celtics paid. He just isn't that guy, like, most of the time. And I think that's one of the things coming. The Celtics believers really sort of make you want to be a Celtics hater. And so every now and then I will cross over and be like, this team, like you, all you guys are crazy. But the reality is that Kyrie is somewhere in the middle and we're just destined to sort of argue about him for until the end of time. And
Yeah, let's put aside the shot for 1 second. Just can you fact check me, though? I'm just struggling to remember. Did Mo Williams or Ben Gordon score 30, 34, 41, 23, 26 in the final 5 games of a final series to win the only championship in franchise history with not the world's best rotation around him against a 73-win team? I don't really remember that. And again, I am not a Kyrie stan. I'm not. I promise you I'm not. There's a lot of guys I would take over him. But he did do that, and
it's
I don't remember Ben Gordon or Mo Williams going quite that ham in the finals.
I don't know, man. Kyrie is just a glorified Ben Gordon. It is what it is. But we should move on. It was a good deal for Boston. That's the thing. And I wrote about
it this week.
It was the only move they had because betting the future on Isaiah was tough, and that sucks for all kinds of different reasons. But it was a smart move. Now, let's move on to the second half of the Celtics blueprint, the new era. Gotti says, why am I always reading and hearing about Anthony Davis being traded to the Celtics? At first, I thought it was just the general Boston media pipeline that was talking about it. But then you guys brought it up too. I get that he's a superstar in a crappy situation, but he's under contract through the 2020-21 season. That's a long time. Even if the Pelicans are horrible next year and AD gets hurt and the Celtics offer literally every asset they have left, the Lakers pick, the Memphis pick, the Clips pick, plus Brown and Tatum, Do you even think that's enough to get AD? I think not. Can we just stop? So the reason that this, that the Anthony Davis rumors are out there is because the Celtics really, like, that's their plan. And I think that, I don't know. I don't think it's that crazy. After we've seen, we just saw Kyrie basically force his way to Boston. And I can't see many other contenders that are going to be good enough and have the assets to land Anthony Davis if he ever decides he wants out. And the other element of this is that New Orleans at some point is going to have to look around and say, look, we're not going to win with just Anthony Davis here, assuming Boogie's on the way out this summer. And like the smart play would be to trade Anthony Davis as soon as they can to get the most value they can. But having said all that, it's still, there's still like so many different moving parts that we, it's like way too early. And the, this emailer is right that like he is under contract. It's not through 2021 because he has a player option in that final year. But he, like 3 years is a long time, and I don't want to get into this mode where like basically halfway through every star player's contract, we start putting them on other teams. So I totally understand.
You're not getting us into that mode though, Andrew. That's the mode the world is in. I think I really respect Gotti's logic in terms of his question here, but I think it's just slightly outdated. When we were talking about Anthony Davis to the Celtics, we were saying next summer, right? Next summer, there will be 2 years guaranteed left on his contract. As you just mentioned, that last year, the third year, would be a player option. That's when these things start to pick up. Let's take Paul George, for example. We knew Paul George was upset in Indiana last summer when he had 2 years left on his contract, right? If you're Indiana, you have the knowledge of what has happened here over the last couple of years. Do you just trade him last summer and be done with it rather than going through an ugly season where nobody was happy, where Paul George is, you know, calling out his teammates during the playoffs and it's just up and down, up and down, up and down, and maximize his value there with 2 years left? Or do you play it out how you did, have everything go crazy, have the agent, you know, leverage you like mad, and wind up settling for a really unattractive package when there's only 1 year left on his contract? I think if you're Indiana, there is a very strong chance or likelihood that they would take the do-over. That's the situation very likely New Orleans is going to be in. The reason why we're talking about this as a realistic trade scenario is because the Pelicans have been pathetic. They've tried a lot. None of it's worked. They have very little talent. They're bringing in Rondo. That's how desperate they are. They're more desperate than Gar Foreman. Not a good situation to be in. And Cousins and Davis hasn't really worked. And even if it works better, it's not going to work well enough where you're really selling hope. I just don't really see that scenario. How good does the Davis-Cousins pairing have to be for everybody to be happy there? You know, if they're a sixth seed, is that good enough? I mean, that to me is, seems like it's above their ceiling. But even then, if you're Anthony Davis, what's better? If you're like, you know, in a Gordon Hayward situation, do you want to be a sixth seed in a very best case in New Orleans, or do you want to go play with Kyrie and win the Eastern Conference Finals? I mean, that seems like a pretty clear comparison. And once it starts to get out that he's unhappy, and I'm not saying he is unhappy yet, let's be really clear right about that. He's been a very good soldier the whole way through this for New Orleans. And by the way, he's already been through a lot, so he does not even owe them that at this point. As soon as it gets out, the vultures are going to be coming hard and fast for the Pelicans because it hasn't been the league's most stable situation, because they very well could go through a coaching and or management change here over the next 12 months if they have another disappointing season, and because he's a truly special talent. I don't want to be in that situation if I'm them, but they are going to get bowled over with really good offers. I think the offer that he laid out from the Boston side was pretty solid. That'd be a good starting point for negotiations. And again, it comes down to, do you take that type of offer with two guaranteed years left, or do you try to talk yourself into an extra year and hope things are going to get better? You know, if he starts to sour, the pressure is going to be on there to take a good deal when you've got it.
Yeah, that's a pretty good way to explain it. And I think that's where we are now, and we just have no idea where it's going to go. My prediction would be that the best case scenario for the Celtics and the most realistic Celtics Anthony Davis trade happens 2 years from now. And I think they're probably better off if they don't get the Lakers pick this year and trade the Kings pick in 2019 with the Memphis pick, which I think also conveys that year, and then the Clippers pick and Brown and Tatum, like whatever they could throw in to make it work. But I also think that, like, for the same reasons Oklahoma City would be wary of trading Westbrook, like New Orleans, that team struggles to sell tickets every year. And if they give up, like giving up Anthony Davis is a last ditch scenario. Even if everybody gets fired this year, I think whoever they hire will come in with a mandate to build around Anthony Davis. So I think that they're really probably not going to look to trade him until 2 years from now, whether that's smart or not.
I agree with you, but I'm not sure it's going to be their choice, right? Like, the players are the ones we've seen consistently.
He could demand it. That's true.
Who flex on the organizations, either behind closed doors or in public. And if you're the new GM and you come to Anthony Davis next summer with your pitch about how you're going to build around him, and he's like, man, I've heard it all before. I've been here for 6 years. We've made zero progress. I haven't won a single playoff game. I've only been to the playoffs once. I'm good. Let's try to work a way out for that's beneficial for both of us. That's basically what happened with Chris Paul down in New Orleans, right? I mean, they just kind of massaged it and made it work. I could easily see that happen. And here's my question for you, and I think this is an even better question about Anthony Davis than some of these scenarios that we're describing. At what point do you start to hold it against him as a competitor if he doesn't start making noise about wanting to get out? Because while I think Paul George did not handle things very well in Indiana, the bottom line is we have to respect his competitive spirit. He wants to win. He made that abundantly clear. I'm not totally sure he knows the right way to win. I mean, certainly jacking 35-footers in the playoffs because he wants to be the guy is probably not the best strategy night in and night out. But at least you saw some ferocity about winning. If you're Anthony Davis, you go through this season, you don't make the playoffs, and you just continue to be this. No, I'm asking you, to be honest, when, and maybe it's not you turning on him because you're a nice guy and you don't really like to turn on players, especially, you know, guys who are good citizens and so forth. But don't you think people will start to turn on Anthony Davis and question him on that? Like, why don't you want more? Why aren't you making noise about getting out? Can't you see that this situation is broken? Shouldn't you be, you know, looking elsewhere for greener pastures?
No. I understand what you're asking, and the answer is no. We have not crossed over to the new NBA so much so that we're going to start docking players for loyalty. Okay, loyalty is dead, but we're not going to start penalizing guys who are like, let me give this one more shot. But I do appreciate the thought, and maybe we'll get there eventually. We'll start asking, like, Devin Booker will be like, Devin Booker, why haven't you forced your way to the Lakers yet? But I don't think we're there.
Well, we opened this thing with T-Mac, though, right? And isn't Anthony Davis headed down a T-Mac-like path here? Like, if he's just cool with New Orleans forever, I'm not, or even just the rest of his contract. Let's say he takes 3 more years and doesn't make the playoffs. Now he's 8 years into the NBA and he's never won a playoff game. Doesn't that define him more than his amazing skills? Isn't that how he's talked about as the guy who's never won anything?
Yeah.
And maybe one of the best players in NBA history who's never won anything. I'm just saying most competitive players who are on that level of their skill would despise that tag, and they would do everything they possibly could to avoid it. And if you realize and come to the conclusion that your organization isn't going to be able to help you with that in a meaningful way, you have to look elsewhere. I don't know. I'm not saying he needs to do this and needs to make a ruckus and a stink, but if he doesn't, I start to look sideways at him around, you know, 2018 or 19.
This is your answer to my Westbrook to the Cavs take, and I appreciate it. By the way, Anthony Davis is not living the T-Mac timeline. He's living the KG timeline, albeit less successfully because the West is much, like, just crazy right now. And I also, one of the things with Anthony Davis that I wonder about is how differently we would talk about him and think about that team if the Pelicans were in the East, because they would probably be like a 6 seed every year. They'd be about where Giannis has the Bucks, which is fine. And it would just be a totally different conversation. Instead of talking about the Pelicans possibly contracting at some point, like, it's just bizarre. I would not want to be a young team in the West. But next question from Saad He says, I'm Saad, one of your very few listeners from France, but a really devoted fan of Open Floor. What up, France? I don't think we've had a French listener before. I may have listened to every one of your shows for the last 2 years. Question for you. Roy Hibbert was an all-star on a championship-caliber team that made the conference finals 2 years in a row. And after a few years of whatever bullshit he went through that made him look like Kwame Brown, he remains unsigned this summer. How did that happen? I don't know, but it made me wonder which current player is the future Roy Hibbert. Which all-star or all-star-caliber player will be irrelevant in the next 3 to 5 years while still being relatively young? Can I tell you a quick story before we answer this?
I really hope it involves, like, Roy Hibbert's breakdown. Yes, please.
It does not involve his breakdown. But Roy Hibbert is from D.C. And went to, like, a rival high school of mine. And I actually, like, when he was, like, I guess he was probably in 10th grade. And he was already sort of, like, on the recruiting radar. And I was a big recruiting nerd growing up. And cared just as much about college basketball as the NBA.
And Wait, hold on. This is back when you were on track to be 6 foot three, right?
Exactly. Future 6 foot three, two guard. And we, at this point, I was a 5'5" two guard, and went and saw Roy Hibbert at a dance, at like a middle school dance, and walked over to him and introduced myself. It was me and a friend, and my friend was a big Kansas fan and made a Kansas recruiting pitch, and I tried to get him to go to North Carolina. And Roy Hibbert, like, at this point he was 7 feet tall even then, and he basically he didn't really acknowledge our existence, but it still was like a cool brushwood celebrity there, and we were super intimidated to talk to him. And looking back, I kind of feel bad because he was probably just really awkward. But that was my first time speaking to an NBA player, future superstar Roy Hibbert.
Let that be a lesson to you guys. You might be the nerd that goes up to the basketball player in seventh grade, but fast forward 15 years later, you can be more famous than that basketball player and have a longer career. That was a really sad story. Have you been fined for tampering yet?
Yeah, maybe. I was certainly trying to tamper on Roy Williams's behalf, but I don't think it worked out very well. As far as the question, I think my pick for this would be Blake Griffin.
Whoa. Well, he wasn't an all-star last year, so that's why I didn't think of him. But that's a good one.
Caliber. He's like a superstar. But I feel like we haven't really talked about how crazy it is that the Clippers gave him as much money as they did for, I think he got 5 years, right?
He did. Yeah. I think a key component of this question though, is the fact that, you know, Hibbert was not playing in the show. That's why he made the All-Star game. That's why he got elevated to the level that he did. I mean, those Pacers teams were pretty solid, but they weren't that good. And we can go back to like last year's All-Star drawing. I mean, remember, the West had two All-Star teams full of players that was better than the East's All-Star team, right? So, like, the odds are if somebody's going to be falling off, they were probably in the Eastern Conference like Hibbert was, because we've cycled through all these, you know, cute stories from the Pacers to the Hawks to the Raptors to the Celtics, and, you know, all these guys kind of come and go, and they're not necessarily, like, top 10 talents. Mm-hmm. So I guess part of what I'm doing is challenging his premise of, like, how good was Roy Hibbert? I mean, Roy Hibbert got a lot of attention. He was definitely on a stage.
Well,
he wasn't really a top 20 guy, you know?
I don't know. He was a defensive force. There, for about 18 months, people talked about Roy Hibbert the way we currently talk about Rudy Gobert, let's say.
Yeah, Rudy Gobert is a lot better than Roy Hibbert, though.
But I'm just saying, like, we didn't realize that at the time, that Roy Hibbert's athleticism was going to be a real limitation. I think...
Great comparison, because Rudy Gobert hasn't made the All-Star team in the West yet, so it's a perfect illustration of what I'm trying to say. It's like Rudy Gobert is much better than Hibbert was at his peak, and yet he doesn't get the same recognition.
Okay, all right. Well, you're just being a hater here, but who's your pick?
Well, unfortunately, I think the odds are, well, first of all, if we're going all-stars, Paul Millsap is probably going to be the guy who's just not talked about 3 years from now, but he's already starting to age out of his prime, so it's a little bit different. I mean, this is going to get dark, And I hope people don't hold this against me, but I think my pick of last year's All-Stars to just fall off the map would be Isaiah.
Come on.
I think it'd be Isaiah.
I mean, yeah, that's true. And Saad mentioned Isaiah as the – that's almost too easy and also too heartless, so I'm going to stick with Blake. But it's true that Isaiah, it's touch and go right now. We have no idea when he's going to come back. I do think that his Players Tribune thing was just awesome. Especially the kicker. If you haven't read it, go check it out. I'm not going to try and like summarize it here, but Isaiah is still as awesome as ever. Let's just hope he can play basketball. But Blake's knees are just as shaky as his hip, as Isaiah's hip, and I think we should all be skeptical there too. But moving on from this dark topic,
real quick though, what about the two Raptors guys, Lowry and DeRozan? I mean, how do you think those guys are going to age?
Lowry's already old, so I don't think he qualifies for like Hibbert status.
I still think he's viewed right now as a better player than Hibbert was at his prime, better all around player.
Yeah,
I mean, me, Lowry's still like a top five point guard. You know, tough position.
When he falls off, people aren't going to be like, what happened to Kyle Lowry? We'll just say,
yeah,
he's 35 now. And DeRozan, yeah, I understand.
But Isaiah's
that,
older
like,
than you think, too, though.
Yeah, that's true. Isaiah's pretty old. He's about to turn 30. DeRozan is not going to fall off the map, and despite how great that would be as Ben Golliver fan fiction, I think he's going to be pretty solid for a while.
We'll see.
Question, though. Tim says, great to have you back, Andrew. You're like the Kyrie Irving of this podcast. A lot of strange opinions, but everything just seems more fun. I've been compared to LaMarcus Aldridge and Kyrie Irving this summer, and it's not acceptable. I don't know whether
Chavis.
The problem is me or the listeners, but it's just not working. His question, though, is the Knicks and Rockets seem locked in a game of chicken regarding Melo. Who do you think blinks first? So I think the most remarkable part of that whole story is how little anyone really cares what happens with the Melo trade. Like, I haven't heard any speculation about it the past few months.
Yeah, no, the leading Melo story has been that he occasionally wears hooded sweatshirts. And the second story is that he's locked in a stalemate of a trade that could potentially influence the entire power balance of the Western Conference. So
that's the thing is, could it really influence the power balance of the conference? The Rockets, as it stands right now, are probably the favorite to be the two seed. I don't think they'll actually be that good. I think they'll be three or four, but I'm not sure. Like, how much does Melo really change it? They're still getting worked in five games by the Warriors, even if they have Carmelo.
Yeah, I was being hyperbolic, just kind of trying to make a joke, which you didn't pick up on. But I guess my point was that, like, he would be, you know, 2 years ago, if you're trading Carmelo Anthony to the biggest threat to the Warriors or the biggest threat to the championship team, that is like an around-the-clock 24/7 news cycle type of thing. And now people are more concerned about making up like fake NBA 2K ratings for Hoodie Melo. You know what I mean? He's just not the same guy. And I mean, it goes for, you could say kind of the same thing about the Chris Paul trade, frankly. Like, I still don't think that's gotten quite enough attention based on how good he actually still is. Whereas if it had happened 2 years ago, it would have melted the internet. You know, Dwayne Wade's in this contract buyout. Does anybody care about that? I mean, outside of South Florida, not really. These guys are getting older. I mean, they're not the centerpiece type guys, the game-changing type players that they were, you know, even a few seasons ago. And I do think the one twist to all of this would be if they did rally in Cleveland. Like, if LeBron just called in every favor, brought the homies, and Wade and Melo both end up in Cleveland, I think that could sort of re-spark it. But I think the lack of attention is actually healthy. I mean, Melo, not the same guy anymore. You know, he's not doing it at that level. And, you know, I guess I'd rather have him than Ryan Anderson. I mean, there's no real question about that if I'm Houston. But it's not an over-the-top type move.
Yeah. There we go again. Hate and ask Golliver. I think you're wrong about why there's not much buzz around this. I don't think it's, I mean, yes, Melo's game has fallen off a little bit, but I don't really think it's a commentary on him as much, or like a correction on how we value him. And the same is true with Chris Paul. I think it's just it speaks to how much better the Warriors are than anyone else. And like, the Rockets can go get Chris Paul, the Rockets can get Melo, and it's not going to matter, because like, it just doesn't change the fundamental equation in the West. And I don't think anybody's going to lie to themselves about it. And in that respect, that is what I think is healthy, is that we're
I think you're wrong.
With clear eyes.
I think you're wrong, because we got really excited about Paul George. We got really excited about Jimmy Butler. I mean, there's the cult of personalities of guys who are still exploring who they can be as players and still in their prime and kind of shaking up these teams. Nobody really thinks Oklahoma City and Minnesota can take down Golden State, but it's new, it's interesting, it's fresh. How's it going to work? That's getting people talking. I just think Carmelo might be old news, man. I think it's kind of headed that direction.
Yeah, I'm still a fan of Melo, and I'm a believer that he could be the right piece somewhere, but I think, yeah, you're probably right, that he'd need to be like the fourth or fifth star.
Why aren't we trying to get Washington back in this mix? I mean, you mentioned that a few times previously. Wouldn't now be the time to strike? I mean, do it.
I would do it, man. I think Melo is like Melo has a lot of flaws, but when you compare him to Markieff Morris and Jan Mahinmi, Melo looks fucking great. And I think it would be a lot of fun. I don't know, like, it depends on how far his value has fallen and how badly the Knicks want him out of there. So I don't know if they would take Kelly Oubre, but I would give Kelly Oubre for Carmelo Anthony, and we could make the salaries work. We could throw in Mahinmi too, whatever. And it's something that, like, I was serious about them doing it a year ago, especially if Melo committed to opting out. And so that this was like a 1 year. We would need a guarantee that Melo is not going to be a long term thing, but it would be fun for 4 months. But yeah, we'll see what happens. Do you think a deal will actually get done before the season starts?
Well, now I'm picturing Melo in like the Paul Pierce role for Washington, pounding his chest after sinking
a
dramatic
first
round game winner over some terrible team. I mean, just throw whoever you want in the mix in terms of the Eastern Conference playoff teams. And I called game, and you can have like this great, rally for a first round playoff game.
You know,
and Melo rediscovers his glory.
It's
sounding
really,
beautiful.
Really sad. It's really sad, because I think about that Paul Pierce team and that, like, it was honestly only fun for about 2.5 weeks, but that run through the Raptors where he swept the Raptors after Raptors fans had talked shit for like all year about how disrespected they were and how nobody paid attention to their team. And then Wall and Pierce go through and sweep the Raptors. And then Pierce was so much fun in that Hawks series before they gave it away at the end. But I look back and think about that like a Spurs fan probably thinks about like the 2007 title the way I think about Paul Pierce on the Wizards. And I don't know. I need bigger dreams.
Well, if Carmelo is the best you've got, good luck with that. But I like him. Honestly, I kind of like him more in Washington than almost anywhere. So I'll give you that.
All right, good. Well, let's move to the podium. Our nonsense portion of the podcast. So first question from Jay Roman. He says, not really a question, but just wanted to point out to you guys, the Lakers actually went over last year. They were at 24.5 coming into last season and won 26 games. I think the Lakers will still go over this year, not even because of Lonzo, but because it's pretty realistic that the other four starters all improved and should offer more spacing. That is crazy. I don't think that the Lakers are going to win like 35 games this year. However, I apologize for getting it wrong. I think we said on the last podcast you could put a kid through college betting the under on the Lakers the last 4 years, and I cannot believe that they actually went over.
Yeah, that's pretty nuts. I think I mentioned how the Knicks will get you one out of every 5 years. That might have been the Lakers one over in the last 5 years, so I wouldn't worry too much about it. But I wouldn't have guessed that. In terms of his argument about their starting five improving, well, you know, you're starting from a pretty low baseline at a lot of those spots. That's not saying a ton. I do think it comes down to Randall, basically, and we were writing about him for the top 100. That guy is just a super flawed player. At least he has been, and he's such a tease. You know, like you think of him as this like guy who's going to bully people and get to the basket and overwhelm you, and all these other things. And in reality, he just misses mid-range jumpers, drives into traffic, and struggles with length, and then just gives up basket after basket after basket on the other side of the floor. I mean, just
that's such
awful
a good
defensive
call.
Awareness. If he somehow breaks through, they could go over. If he is still just the same guy over the last couple of years, they're not going to go over. I think that he's basically their X factor to me.
It's a great point. I will believe in the new era of the Lakers if they trade Julius Randle and or at least find a long-term plan that makes more sense than trying to talk yourself into Julius Randle every year. Because
the best part is last year you tried to talk yourself into Julius Randle. You said he was going to be the next Draymond. Do you remember that?
Yeah, no, I did not ever say that, but I did. I don't know. Some of the worst takes in this podcast's history came from that first 3 weeks of Lakers optimism where I was really all in, and that did not age well at all. But moving on. Next question is from Ted, who says, I am surely not the only listener disappointed in your recent Ricky ranking on the enemies of the process. It sounds like your wrestling style opposition to the process has been a convenient cover. Please take this opportunity to publicly repudiate Sam, Spike and Mike, LL Pervorsky, Cheesesteaks, Pretzels, Rocky, Ben Franklin, as the Wizards start their inevitable slide. Do you have any idea what he's talking about, Ben?
That seemed like it was written in a different language. I mean, I caught a few of the Philadelphia references. I'm big fans of Spike and Mike, thanks to you. But the rest of it, I mean, I'm assuming Sam is Hank Geek and they just referred to him by his first name because he's their leader and their god or whatever. But the rest of it made no sense.
Yeah, I like that they refer to Sam simply by his first name, because my first time reading this, I was like, wait, who's Sam? And then... yes, it is Hinky. And so Spike and Mike, hosts of Rights to Ricky Sanchez, great Sixers podcast. They recently recorded an off-season podcast where they went through the top 10 enemies of the process over the past 4 years. And I was included as an honorable mention. They put my face on the like little podcast thumbnail. So I saw that and went and listened to it. And I listened to it on a run, and it actually was like pretty crazy to listen to, because it was like overly personal and like in a funny way, but it was super petty with all sorts of local Philly people that I'm not really familiar with. And then they were just firing off takes at like Stan Van Gundy and Doug Collins. And it was, as I ran, I was like, Jesus, it's really August right now. We're lecturing Stan Van Gundy about process takes from 3 years ago. But to answer your question, Ted, I love Spike and Mike. We are actually real friends in real life, and I was disgusted to not be included in the top 10 of the process enemies, because I lived with Mike every day, and for a solid 12 months. Like we actually weren't friends when we moved in together. And for a solid 12 months, we bonded over basketball and argued about the Sixers every goddamn day. And he was so insufferable and has moved the goalposts so much over the past few years, because when the process began, we lived together in 2013. He would say things like, 4 years from now, like we're going to be in the Eastern Conference Finals, and it like Sam has a plan and it's all going to happen. And since then, the goalposts have moved, but I'm happy for the Sixers, and I've slowly come over to be a friend of the Rights to Ricky Sanchez podcast, but I will always be an enemy of the stupid goddamn process.
Well, glad we did that. That was fun.
I'm really sorry. All right, let's see. We have two more questions. First is from Casper, who says, during Andrew's honeymoon, Ben's had some amazing and truly interesting guests on the show, like Kevin Pelton, Chris Ballard, Rob Mahoney. Next summer, when Ben is off on his honeymoon with his drone, who would Andrew pick as his realistic choice of guests, and what would the topics be?
Stop playing me, Casper. Come on now.
I really only included that for the ether at Golliver and his long-term relationship with the drone. As far as guests are concerned, the one guy I really want to talk to is Dave McMenamin, because he has the Cavs beat, which I think would be fascinating. But I also, he was the original blogger who worked with Gilbert Arenas like 10 years ago and to write his NBA.com blog that sort of like got me into the NBA internet. And then probably just a bunch of like Grantland people, Juliet and Chris. But more important question would be from Pick and Poppy. Hey, Ben, are you part of a social network of drone operators? There's a VW van show going on September 16th in Huntington Beach, California, and I'm trying to contact a drone operator to take pics with my family and the vans. Shot in the dark. Thought you might be the person to ask.
I've almost never been more honored to be thought of. Unfortunately, I'm not going to be in town for that, or I probably would go. That sounds awesome. The VW van culture thing is big in Southern California. Remember that when you were here, right? Like, they're just sort of everywhere, and they're like really immaculately kept, and they're always down there by the beaches. And
I had no idea that was a thing. Is that like a Manhattan Beach lifestyle thing?
Yeah, and even further down south, I mean, you know, the OC, they're just kind of always there. It's definitely a cult. So I love the idea of like the two cults like intersecting here with drone operators and VW van guys. I am picturing like a drone crashing into one of these classic VW vans and just leading to like gunfire because someone damaged the vehicle they've been working like 50 years to restore. So I got a little nervous when I thought about the flying overhead. Unfortunately, I won't be in town for this event, so I couldn't do it. And I'm actually not a part of a social network of drone operators other than Instagram, where I do follow a number of drone photographers. So I couldn't really help Pick and Poppy, but phenomenal question. If you think you could do better than Pick and Poppy, email us openfloormail@gmail.com.
Wait, hold on, though.
That was awesome.
Is there a social network of drone operators?
I'm sure there is. There's message boards. I've consulted message boards before because there's lots of rules and regulations about this thing. And so guys have to swap tips about, you know, the best places to shoot and so forth. So there's definitely online resources.
Yeah,
but I don't know if there's
Have you been on
I don't know if there's dronergram or whatever.
Have you been on a drone message board before?
I have read. I've never written. Okay. I've read. I'm a lurker. I'm a drone message board lurker.
Good.
But while we're on this subject, I really got to take a shot at you for your terrible advice on the last podcast. Because do you remember what you told me about my Instagram on the last podcast? You want to refresh people's memory?
All I asked on the last podcast was that you post pictures of your magnet collection, particularly the editions this summer, and you still have yet to share those with the people. So
that's a very convenient rewriting of history. Very convenient, because what you actually said was, I need more shots on the ground. That's what you were kind of like pushing me towards, and you were trying to say get away from the nature of photography. So the very next day, I took that to heart. I said, Andrew, he's got more Instagram followers than I do. I'm really on the struggle gram. Like, I need to try to step this up, right? So I followed your advice, and I posted a beautiful photo, Americana, father and son at a small town rodeo. Beautiful shot, great lighting, in my opinion. It didn't even get 100 likes, Andrew. And if you go back and look at all of my nature photos, I'm well over 100 on every single one of them. I don't think you really know what the people want as much as you think you do.
Look, if you post, if you post the magnets, I will tweet it out, and we will take this to various other social platforms, and we can really blow it up, okay? I will signal boost on your behalf, so you won't be complaining about likes, but I do appreciate the covert ask for Instagram followers at the end of this podcast, and really, anyone who made it through the last 15 minutes of nonsense, particularly the process rant, I salute you, and it's great to be back.
If you didn't turn it off after Ted, you're a true open floor listener. We appreciate it.
I really appreciate all the questions this week. We didn't get to a handful, I missed the mailbags. We will be back next week. We've got a couple podcasts planned around the top 100. Look out for Ben. I today wrote about the MVP odds for this year, which was actually a lot of fun. And so we'll talk about that at some point as well. But yeah, man, you're traveling to New York. I will be in New York on Tuesday. Travel safe. Bring your drone, and I will see you soon.
All right, bro. Take care.
Another great edition of Open Floor is in the books. Did you know Locked On has a daily podcast for all 30 NBA teams? If you're a Lakers fan, search Locked On Lakers. A Celtics fan, search Locked On Celtics. Warriors fans, search Locked On Warriors. Yes, all 30 NBA teams have a daily bite-sized podcast on the Locked On Podcast Network. Search on Apple Podcasts or Google Podcasts for Locked On, your favorite team. Or tell your smart speaker to play podcasts Locked On, your favorite team.
It's the Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day.